You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host from Newark, Delaware, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on July 7th, 2013 from our studio in Newton, Massachusetts. Ahead this hour, Persephone and I discuss low-wage jobs, abortion rights, and the crisis in Egypt. All this is just ahead on Arsenal for Democracy. This is Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey. I'm here in studio again with our new co-host, Persephone. Welcome back to the show, Persephone.
Thank you, Bill.
All right, well, let's jump right in on some domestic news. Last week on our extended internet version of our show that did not make it to the FM version for time reasons, we were talking about the Texas abortion battle. But Texas is far from the only place where this is an issue in the past few weeks. So I wanted to kind of talk about this some more. The reason that of course that I bring this up a lot on the show is because this is part of a systematic effort over the past several years. In 2011 and 2012, those were record years, I think first and second respectively, for post-Roe v. Wade efforts to try to chip away at Roe v. Wade. These assaults on abortion rights and reproductive freedom are part of a systematic effort that we do need to discuss as a progressive news show. Persephone, why don't you walk us through some of the points that are being raised in the Texas debate beyond some of what the headlines are saying about this situation. I think we first have to understand kind of what we're talking about before we get into the nuts and bolts of the actual debate.
Well, a lot of the focus on the Texas situation has been on the filibuster and the heroic efforts of Democrats and of pro-choice activists. But there's very little explanation of the contents of the Texas bill. If this bill does have success, it would result in a huge cutback on abortion. So, for instance, it would force 90% of clinics to close because of very tough restrictions on what abortion providers can do, how they have to update their buildings. The bill throws in all these sorts of details and red tape that abortion providers would have to go through. And there would only be 5 in the entire state of Texas.
Yeah, and this is something that we've talked about previously on the here on Arsenal for Democracy, this idea that they can't get away with direct bans, so they come up with these sort of routes around the problem. And this was especially, they were testing a lot of these in North Dakota of these, as you mentioned, these clinic restrictions, which is sort of ironic that they're big, pro-business Republicans are the ones imposing regulatory red tape as a means of tripping up something. So the idea in North Dakota that's now being exported to Texas and a number of other states right now as well is that you change the licensing restrictions, you change the facilities requirements, et cetera, and then that limits the, it forces, for budget reasons, it forces some of the clinics to close, and then for the reasons of not being able to have surgeons or other medical professionals on hand at all times, it forces some of the other clinics to close because, if you're not within a certain number of miles of a hospital or your only hospital within a certain radius is a Catholic hospital, for example, that doesn't license people for those procedures, then you can't meet these requirements. But the requirements are not medically necessary or otherwise necessary. They're just a way of coming up with sort of this roundabout route of restricting access to abortion rights, even if you're not actually technically restricting the abortion rights. It reminds me a lot of the health insurance, healthcare debate, which is this issue of, do people have health care or do they have access to health care? Because the United States healthcare system is relatively good in some particular areas, is better than a lot of other countries, but it doesn't do a whole lot if people don't have access to that. So let's talk also about some of the other states in addition to Texas, which has been getting the bulk of the headlines. There are a number of other states where this has been happening just in the past couple weeks. What was the situation in Ohio? I think that was particularly noteworthy because that was thrown in on a budget amendment, and then they had a governor who is a man signing it with no women in the picture. Literally, the photograph of the signing was just all men.
Yeah. It's very striking to see one guy surrounded by other men and signing into law something
and
that
he had a line item veto over a lot of stuff because it's a budget bill, and they had that. They have the line item veto in Ohio, and he apparently vetoed 22 amendments to the bill, so he could have easily chopped it out. But of course, he's a very conservative Republican, former member of Congress, and so he put in five new provisions there. So could you walk us through some of that as well?
Absolutely. So in Ohio, we have seen the governor doing everything in his power to restrict abortion, defunding Planned Parenthood, and giving the funds instead to crisis pregnancy centers, which is something that, in addition to affecting abortion in a straightforward way by making it harder for women to get abortions, also means that women are going to be misled and possibly put at risk. Because for those who don't know, crisis pregnancy centers, what they do is they disguise themselves as Planned Parenthoods or abortion providers with messages to women like, if you are pregnant and have a decision to make, you know, come and see us. And then they end up giving misleading information. And
well, call it what it is. A lot of them are flat out lying. I mean, if you're saying that like abortion is linked to increased breast cancer rates and stuff like that, it's like, well, you're just making stuff up now at this point.
Right.
So let's also talk about North Carolina now. That's where it's also been coming up. Ohio did it as a budget measure. North Carolina did it as part of a Sharia law bill. They wanted to say something about that. I'm really hazy on all these anti-Sharia bans, which are kind of nutty and weird. I mean, Oklahoma just did it as a straight ban that said that Sharia law couldn't supersede the laws of the United States or whatever, because that, not that it was a risk. But I guess the way that it came up was that North Carolina was working on a family law amendment. So sometimes instead of using the secular family law courts, people prefer to go through divorce or custody battles within their religious faiths, and assuming that those comply with the general laws, they usually will allow that to happen. It's sort of a way of, you know, maybe more amicably settling the matter, at least theoretically. And so, you know, a lot of times we would hear about that probably in relation to members of the Jewish faith going through their divorce proceedings and that sort of thing, and then it's handed off to the, you know, provide a secular divorce as well. But Muslims sometimes go through the Sharia family courts in North Carolina. I guess, I don't know if they were trying to ban it outright or if they were just trying to say that it, like Oklahoma, that this non-existent threat, you know, I think they were trying to ban it outright, but they could have just been saying that it wasn't going to supersede any U.S. laws, which it wouldn't anyway. They ended up at the last minute in the Senate trying to stick in this amendment that was going to do what exactly? It was it was some of the imaginary problems like banning sex selective abortions, which is not a problem in the United States. There's like basically no record that that's been an issue.
Also restricting access to the abortion pill, which is actually one of the better ways for early abortion. So they're effectively forcing women to choose surgical procedures, which might mean that they would have to have the abortion later. So under the pretense of making it harder for women to get later term abortions, they're actually they're forcing women to get later term abortions by banning or by restricting the use of the abortion pill.
Delightful. Let's get your kind of macro level thoughts on all of this. We talked a little bit about it on the show last week, but for those who missed that episode or only heard the radio version, what's the outlook on these in general? And, are these going to get tied up in court? Is this where we're heading now? Is this the trend? Is there a way to push back on some of these to protect women's rights? What's the sort of overall situation?
I think it's going to be very hard to take this to court. I think people are reluctant to take it to court because they're not sure about how to get the Supreme Court on board. I mean, I think that, you know, Kennedy being the sort of swing justice, you know, he has upheld Roe v. Wade in the past, But I think people are always just very nervous about taking things that high if it could mean more restrictions on abortion in general.
I think that's definitely a good point. I think both sides are always going to be a little bit nervous about this. And the reason that there's a big push happening now is a combination of the fact that they finally got a lot of control of state legislatures in the 2010 elections on the conservative side, but also that, as you say, they now know that they have a pretty good chance of getting some of these restrictions approved by the Supreme Court in a way that they did not previously. In the past, Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, when she was on the court, was one of the people who, although she did roll back part of Roe v. Wade and made some changes through the Casey v. Planned Parenthood decision in 1993, she was probably one of the people who would have previously been that swing vote that was making sure that there were enough votes to continue holding the line on at least some abortion rights for women and other reproductive rights. But as you say, that swing vote role is now moved over to Kennedy, who is further to the right, especially on some of these issues. And that makes it more of an open question, which means that these are probably going to get tied up in court battles. But then, you know, it really is an open question as to what happens if it gets to the Supreme Court. All right, well, why don't we turn now to a broader economic topic, which is the recovery that's been happening. Usually every month or so, the general trend has been in the, you know, supposed right direction in terms of improving the job numbers. And that has certainly been better than not, but there is a little bit of an asterisk with this recovery, as I think people have been kind of watching and waiting for and pointing to and warning about for a number of years now, which is that although jobs are being added to the economy, as Aviva Shen from Think Progress noted on July 5th, the bulk of these jobs were concentrated in low-wage service industry jobs or temp worker-type jobs and various other related things, hospitality, retail. A lot of those jobs are paying less than $14 an hour. A lot of them don't have good benefits. The other thing that a lot of people who are familiar with these industries and pay attention to these or know people who work in them is that partly in relation to the Obamacare stuff is that these companies are hiring people for fewer hours but demanding that they be available for more flexible hours. So they get around the requirements to have to pay them benefits and health insurance benefits that'll be coming up under the Affordable Care Act when that kicks into effect. But they're preventing people from getting a second job to supplement the sort of underemployment that they have from the one job. So in the past, if someone was working, say, 20 hours, they would say, okay, these are my 20 hours that I'm working at McDonald's or at some other relatively low-paying job. And then they could say, okay, well, I can go pick up 20 or 40 more hours at some other job in the defined time that is not when I'm working at this first job. That becomes a bit of a problem when they start saying, no, you're going to only be working 20 hours a week, but you have to be available for this whole range of potential hours and we'll call you as needed. That makes it impossible for you to then go out and get a second job. And this is a really big problem because economists will talk about, you know, oh, you can't raise the minimum wage because that's going to raise unemployment, because the theoretical way that it works on paper is that if you are arbitrarily, you know, so-called arbitrarily raise the wages, then the other thing that must come down is the hiring. So if you force employers to pay more, then they must be hiring fewer people. In fact, what typically is my understanding of the situation and seems to be confirmed by people who work these lower wage jobs is that if you raise the minimum wage, it means that people who previously had to work two jobs to make ends meet now can finally quit their second or even third job and only work on a primary job that actually pays them enough to cover their basic expenses. So the only job losses created by minimum wage hikes are generally eliminating second or third jobs. They will be supplemented as needed by lower wage, you know, under the table illegal immigration usually, unfortunately. But the notion that it's going to cause unemployment to raise these wages is simply not actually the case in the vast majority of circumstances. But it it's important to understand how this works functionally on the ground as opposed to on paper, which is this idea that for these low-paying jobs, most people, unless they're, say, you know, an affluent teenager who's just doing it to get some spending money for, you know, going to buy some jeans at TJ Maxx, these people who are working these relatively low-wage jobs, they need to work other jobs to be able to make ends meet because these pay so little, but they cannot do that now when they're being forced to work these irregular shifts and have more flexibility but fewer hours. That becomes a very serious problem, and it's probably not that great for the overall health of the economy anyway if people are employed but making very little money because, as we've talked about previously on the show, people who have less money, lower income, are more likely to spend a higher proportion of their income because they have to. They have less money available overall. They have to spend a lot of that on essentials like food, rent, maybe car payments if they have to, you know, travel and they're not in a good area with public transportation, things like that. That these are the necessities that they have to cover first. And the way that the U.S. economy, like it or not, is set up is that it's a consumer-driven economy. So about 60% of the economic growth is coming from people spending money on things. And a lot of that is coming from so-called discretionary spending. So that means that if you have these low-wage jobs where people basically are making just enough or maybe not even enough to cover their basic expenses, they don't have any money left over to spend on other things, these discretionary purchases that are the main drivers of the economic growth. And that is going to have a ripple effect because it's basically reversing the money multiplier. So the money multiplier effect is where if I spend a dollar to you to buy something that you're selling, then you now have a dollar that you can spend on something else, and then that person's going to be able to maybe hire another worker or, you know, spend it on something else in turn. And usually the money multiplier is going to work out to be something like that. If I spend a dollar, it's going to end up multiplying its economic impact to about $5 because of people turning around and spending that. If you don't have that discretionary spending, that effect is canceled. So that means you've now pulled out for every dollar that someone at the beginning of the chain can't spend, that is a loss of $5 out of the overall economy. And of course, multiply this out by, you know, the huge scale of the U.S. economy and the massive labor force, this becomes a very serious problem. And this is part of what is slowing the recovery. The fact that these job creation numbers are coming from these low-wage and temporary jobs is actually preventing the economy from recovering as quickly. And it's a contributing factor in the U.S. median income, median assets, and everything else declining in real terms since the beginning of 2000. I think it's down almost 9%, which means that not even in nominal inflationary terms, but in real terms, people are making less money, about 9% less money than they were making in 2000 on average. So Persephone, you wanted to jump in on some of this. Go ahead.
Yeah. To return for a minute to the people working two low-paid jobs thing, another important element, I think, of that is just free time. And I think that what people often forget, if somebody is working two jobs, it's not like they're working, you know, at McDonald's and then they just go to Burger King next door. I mean, sometimes I suppose it can be like that. But a big part of that time is going to be spent in getting from one job to another, which means that people during the day, they don't have the same time. You know, you're working Monday through Friday, or even on Saturdays and Sundays, you're not going to have time to go out and do not only things like pursuing entertainment, seeing movies, or going to restaurants or bars and stimulating the economy in that way, but also just the day-to-day things like, you know, going to the bank or going to the library. You're just not going to have the time in your day. You're not going to have any downtime to take care of the errands that you need. And that's important because people need to stay organized to stay on top of their finances. And if you're running in different directions every day, it's going to be very hard to keep a tight budget and to keep your family afloat. And these are not teenagers who are doing a summer job and are kind of inconvenienced by having to, pull an all-nighter because they have to stay late at one job and then get up early the next morning for their next job. These are people with families that need to support their families and need to support their own children just to get by.
Right. So effectively, the other impact here that you're pointing out, which I hadn't really thought that much about, is that a factor in the rising personal debt problems that have especially plagued the low-income people is that in addition to all these, you know, predatory lending problems that we already have, you have people who are having trouble just staying on top of everything because they're not making that much money and they're having to spend more time running around to second and third jobs than, you know, balancing their checkbooks or whatever. And you know, that they don't have, and they also probably don't have enough time to, you know, go through the grocery store and find all the lowest price versions of everything or, you know, whatever, like they just, it just becomes overwhelming and they, you know, it's going to be a lot easier to lose a handle on your finances. And that's not their fault or anything that they can fix necessarily. It's just something that is forced on them kind of by circumstance. Do you have any ideas on what can be done? I mean, I think that this has been a really big problem for a while now. It's kind of maybe only just starting to get national attention because it's a national issue at this point. But I think the state of Texas, for example, has been bragging for years and getting, you know, favorable covers on The Economist and stuff like that about how great they've been doing at job creation and XYZ, whatever. And to some extent, there's been criticism that Governor Perry's administration has been kind of pulling jobs out of other states. And that's where a lot of their job growth has come from. But more importantly than that, I think at least a quarter, if not a half of the jobs in Texas at this point are these low-paying jobs and temporary jobs, low-wage jobs, service economy jobs, hospitality jobs, things like that, that are just not cutting it. You know, and people are not making enough money from these to be spending money into the economy, working on other projects, starting up businesses, things like that, that they could potentially be doing if they had more time and more discretionary income. It kind of traps people in this sort of borderline servitude state where the only thing they can be doing is working just enough to, you know, get up, feed themselves, maybe feed their kids and go to work and then come and do it again. That's how it definitely used to work back in the day. But the idea of industrializing our economy was that we were going to free up some, you know, people to be able to work on other things and to be able to do stuff other than work. As you say, for example, if people are not able, they don't have the free time and discretionary income to go to the movies, well, no surprise there that the movie industry has been struggling so much in the past several years at the box office that they have seen some pretty unprecedented drop-offs there. I mean, there's a number of factors there, but I would imagine that this is a contributing factor, certainly. And I think that it is a serious problem when the economy becomes dependent on those kind of jobs. Is this the future for the United States economy, or is there a way of turning this back? Any ideas? Throw open the floor on this one.
Well, I think we know what the solution is, or what the solutions are, or at least some of them. You know, there are concrete things the government could do, first and foremost being raise the minimum wage. But also, you know, a few years ago, Rachel Maddow had this great thing where she looks at food stamps. And, you know, I think that something like food stamps, they might be a sort of temporary solution, but they really help the economy because when you're not worrying about food, you can spend your money on other things. And then beyond that, those are things the government can do, but they're not getting done. So in terms of what individuals can do, I think that people who are working these kinds of jobs, they unfortunately do not have very many options. It's very hard to unionize the service industry because of the nature of the kinds of jobs. Because people are taking on these shifts at random hours, they have trouble getting to know their coworkers. There's trouble organizing. And I think in some ways that's deliberate.
Well, I wanted to touch on the food stamps or SNAP program issue that you were talking about. A couple months ago, when I was in Delaware, I met the head of the Delaware Food Bank, and she was talking about, this was actually the context through which I met her happened to be at this primarily libertarian event that I was at for another reason. I'm not a libertarian, obviously, as I think everyone on who listens to the show knows. But they of course were more skeptical of a program like food stamps, and they were asking her kind of what the impact of the program was, how much it mattered, were there other ways of achieving the same goal of making sure that people have enough to eat and that kids have proper nutrition, etc. And you know, her answer quite bluntly was that she was advocating for increased food stamp access and SNAP access and things like that. And again, this is someone whose job at this nonprofit is to provide a non-governmental means. The vast majority of their budget non-governmental. They get very little money in grants there. The idea is this is a non-governmental means of providing food and achieving that goal. And she was saying that the bulk of the people who they serve at the Delaware Food Bank are people who are already on programs like SNAP, and that only generally is enough money to provide them with food for their families through about the first 3 weeks of every month. So they get a certain amount of money credited to a card at the beginning of the of every month. They can get through about 3 weeks and then they run out. They're out of money, cannot feed their family. The program is severely underfunded, and it's been in doubt since the failure of the farm bill a couple months ago or a month or so ago. They have to go to the food bank to supplement the supplemental nutritional assistance program. The fact that it's not even just helping the people who are kind of on that margin of being eligible, not eligible for the program, it's that people who are absolutely this program was designed for and can't get by without that, can't even get by with it, that they have to go and get this additional private assistance from the food bank. That is a pretty serious problem, and so I agree with your point there that needs to be changed as well. You know, and I think it's a broad, multifaceted problem here. We've got to get the income up through minimum wage increases and other things. We probably need to be regulating a little bit better to make sure that these irregular shifts don't become an institutionalized issue. We need to make sure that everyone is fed properly. That has huge ramifications. There was a study from the World Bank recently, and I don't know necessarily what the numbers would look like in the United States, but they were saying that in Africa and Asia, the impact of malnutrition alone on the national economies there is just enormous, because the effect of not having enough food within the first 2 years of your life has a lifetime effect on your physicality, your height, your stature, all those things, but also your earning potential and everything, to the extent that malnutrition costs billions and billions of dollars and a gigantic percentage of GDP for the entire African and Asian continent. And I would imagine that there's probably lesser effects like that in the United States, but similar problem there, that we've got to get kids fed properly so that they can be learning in school, not distracted, et cetera, because that's going to have a long-term economic problem. And we've got to make sure that, you know, everyone has access to, you know, education, public education, probably pre-K, as well as making sure that everyone has access to proper health care at an affordable rate.
But of course, on top of that, productivity in the United States is at a high, and wages aren't rising to meet that productivity.
Yeah, workers are working harder, but they're making less money than they were 13 years ago.
I think that that's part of what we're seeing, is that the data that we're getting does not necessarily reflect what's really going on. So we can look at the GDP and say, oh, that's great. And we can look at employment and say, oh, look, all these people are employed. But when they're being employed, when somebody goes from having a steady job to having a part-time job with an erratic schedule, that's not really progress.
We'll be right back with more Arsenal for Democracy with me, Bill Humphrey, and my co-host Persephone in just a few moments. So stick around, and we'll be back with a discussion of the situation in Egypt shortly. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm Bill Humphrey, and I'm here again in studio with my co-host Persephone. Let's get into the Egypt news of the past week. That's been dominating most of the headlines. That's what I've been spending most of my time thinking about for the past week. So why don't we recap kind of the discussion we were having before off air about what the actual factual situation was when everything played out. So basically, in 2011, the 30-year dictator Hosni Mubarak was toppled by popular protest, and more correctly, the military threw him out of office. They had kind of a grudge against him in the past, you know, in the final few years of his regime, because he was planning to put his son on the presidency or throne or whatever equivalent there, instead of one of them. And the economy under Mubarak and still has been a complete disaster in Egypt. They lack the resources to properly finance themselves. They have to get a lot of foreign aid, military aid, and subsidies just to kind of keep the lights on. They don't have a major, you know, oil reserve that they can tap into like a lot of other countries in the region have. They have to import a lot of their energy. They have to subsidize basic food and those sort of things. This becomes a big problem. One of the major employers in the economy is the Egyptian army. They have a huge military. I think it's close to 500,000 people. That keeps a lot of the unemployment down in the country, but still the joblessness rate was hitting in the last couple weeks or months or so was hitting about, I think, 13%, which wasn't great on top of the already bad situation. And they, so economically kind of a black hole, the military, one of the biggest employers, continued to have a big, huge role in the economy after they took out the Mubarak regime. They initially led a transitional government. That became a bit of a problem because they started cracking down when people were unhappy with how things were going, started doing a lot of the same beating of protesters that was happening under the Mubarak regime. Again, kind of hard to tell the difference between the Mubarak regime and the military. They were pretty close, kind of part and parcel of the same thing, which is going to make the news of the past week a lot more interesting in that context, certainly. And so what they did was they came up with a plan to have an election of a president. Now, you would think you'd probably want to get a constitution in place first, but kind of one of the problems that they were having was that how were they going to come up with this procedure for drafting a constitution that was fair and allowed everyone access when they hadn't really been able to test so far kind of the strength of the various political factions and the organization. Of course, the biggest, most organized party, long illegal under the Mubarak government, was the Muslim Brotherhood, which was sort of the moderate political Islam movement there in Egypt, had renounced violence a long time ago and so forth. So they ended up deciding to hold a presidential election before they had actually come up with a constitution. So the game plan here was hold a presidential election, get a president in office, have the president appoint a transitional cabinet, come up with some procedure for drafting a constitution, elect a parliament, and roll from there, yay democracy, and so on and so forth. They had this election, 51% of the country voted for Mohamed Morsi to become president, and he was from the Muslim Brotherhood, educated in the United States, somebody that was a little bit tricky to work with from the United States perspective, but certainly not that difficult as maybe they had been worried about. Was pretty accommodating on some of the Israel stuff, surprisingly. The military kind of just left its position in place from the 1979 treaty and maintained border control, etc. And the Morsi government worked with the Obama administration on calming down the situation in Gaza a couple times when Israel and the Palestinians there were having difficulties or were fighting again. So somebody that the United States could work with, but obviously not the United States' first pick for that. My kind of thoughts on this from a broad standpoint are that if you're calling for having free elections and someone gets freely elected, you have to accept that they've been freely elected and you can't be complaining after the fact, which is a thing that keeps happening with the United States. Now, there's potentially an argument to be made that you should be thinking a little bit more broadly about what your definition of democracy is. But as long as the United States is publicly defining democracy for the purposes of its foreign policy rhetoric as holding free elections, you don't get to complain when Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood wins your elections that you insisted on putting on. Same with Hezbollah in Lebanon. If they're the biggest, most organized, and most favored political party and they win, well, that's the consequence of pushing for democracy, which is a good goal to be pushing for. But yeah, there's probably an argument to be made about broadening the definition to include a little bit more than just holding elections. particularly because of this awkwardness where the Constitution hadn't been written yet when they held the presidential election. So Morsi gets into power, tries to come up with a plan for drafting a constitution, having parliamentary elections. The Mubarak-aligned judiciary annulled the elections for parliament that Muslim Brotherhood won, like they had won the presidency, saying that it was illegally created under the transition plan, that the constitution was something was wrong with it, or that it was come up with improperly, blah, blah, blah. So ended up being that there was just these three centers of power, the judiciary, the military, and the Morsi government in the presidency that was backed up by the political operations of the Muslim Brotherhood, but was not backed up by a parliament. Morsi then proceeds to go and fire a bunch of the generals, and nothing really happened when he did, which was a huge surprise to everyone. He was kind of trying to do the Turkey model of defanging the military so that they wouldn't overthrow him as they had overthrown his predecessor. As I said, people were surprised initially that that worked, and apparently he was more cocky about that than he should have been, because when he ends up getting thrown out of power last week, it turns out that the United States had been trying to work with him on saying, let's come up with some sort of compromise so you don't get kicked out of office. And he said, no, I'm all set because the military won't overthrow me, and they did. So we have a situation where there is a democratically elected leader in office, of course, is doing some things that some people don't like. That's how democracy works. You kind of, like, you just have to expect that sometimes they're going to do things that you don't like, especially if you lost and a majority of the country voted somebody else in. And of course, that's the other problem with these revolutionary situations, is that there is always going to be a large rural population that kind of doesn't care either way who's in power, because things aren't really going to change that much for them. And in Egypt's situation, and this would probably apply to places like Iran as well, you have this kind of conservative rural majority that isn't going to take to the streets over things, but does support, say, the Muslim Brotherhood, for example. And so whether or not you, as a liberal in Egypt, like the Morsi government, he is popularly backed up, but arguably the head of a not all that democratic government, although democratically elected himself. So the protesters take to the streets again last week. The liberals out in full force in this weird partnership with the Salafist Al-Nur Party. Now, the Salafists are basically kind of like the ultra-Muslim Brotherhood. They're not linked to the Muslim Brotherhood, but they are Islamists, but they are a lot more extreme and a lot more conservative. So very strange to see them working with the liberals, because they're basically the polar opposite of liberals. Salafism... as a political movement linked very closely to Al-Qaeda and other type violent political Islam. Although I think technically they have renounced violence in Egypt as well, but that's a much more recent development within the past 10 or 15 years than, say, the Muslim Brotherhood, which renounced violence quite a while ago. So the Salafist party, Al-Nur, comes up with this so-called transition plan, which would kick Morsi out of power, turn over a transitional government to the military again, put somebody from the judiciary in as the interim president, and then would kind of have this unofficial back-channel coalition thing between the liberals, who are liberal but undemocratic, and the undemocratic conservatives, in the Salafist side. The military ends up going along with this plan, issues a 48-hour ultimatum last week, basically telling everyone there's about to be a military coup in 2 days. Morsi refuses to accept this, is arrested. 200 members of the Muslim Brotherhood senior leadership are arrested. The Muslim Brotherhood's TV channels are shut down. State television and a bunch of other channels are either shut down or turned to support the overthrow of the Morsi government. And that is kind of the situation that we're at now, except that there's also been clashes because, as I said, the Morsi was representing the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the biggest, most popular political party that had won two elections, even if one of them was annulled. And even though the military overthrew him, they are probably still the most popular. And so there have been clashes there in the streets, some reports of gun violence, according to the New York Times. That's something that's pretty unusual. That's something that you'd see a lot more likely in a country like Yemen, that's one of the most highly armed per capita nations on earth. And when they had their revolutionary situation a couple of years ago as part of the Arab Spring, there was a lot more street violence involving guns there, although not, of course, to the extent of the, say, Syrian civil war. which is as I said, a full-scale civil war. So there are clashes. It remains to be seen what happens now. The military trying to put yesterday Mohammed al-Baradei, the Nobel Peace Prize-winning, globally respected liberal, in power as this unelected prime minister. I happen to think that's kind of ridiculous and that he should be ashamed of himself because he shouldn't be supporting such undemocratic moves. Now, the people in the military and the liberals who are wanted the ouster of this moderate government are saying that the revolution was betrayed, that this was an undemocratic government, you know, and that they are trying to save the democratic promise of the revolution. But really, a lot of this is just being upset about the continued economic problems. But no one is going to be able to fix this. The Egyptian military is not going to be able to fix this. No one is really in a position to fundamentally fix the Egyptian economy. I mean, I suppose that the Egyptian military is theoretically in the position to do the most because they could disentangle themselves from the economy, but they're not going to do that. Part of the reason that they overthrew the government here, of course, was that it was taking away part of their power and influence, or attempting to. It's fundamentally the same reason that they took out the Mubarak government before that. So that is the situation that we're at right now. Now, there's been all kinds of analysis on what this means. Was this democracy? What are the consequences here? And that's what I wanted to talk about today with you in the next few minutes before we wrap up the show. I think that this is a pretty serious problem. I think at minimum it sets a very bad precedent in Egypt, but I think it also sets a bad precedent for other regimes around the world, which is this idea that if things start getting difficult, you can just overthrow the government whenever. And I think this is kind of a misunderstanding of a lot of these newer democracies or democracies that are still working on getting these values entrenched. You know, if abuse of power by the president or something were grounds for a military overthrow, we would have done it a bunch of times in the United States by now. That's not how the system is supposed to work. At some point, you have a procedure for removing presidents during the middle of the term, or you have a system like a British parliamentary type system where you can do a snap election. You have various safeguards like that built in. Of course, it's a problem when you don't have a constitution, I guess. But you come up with a system and you follow that system. In the case of the United States, we don't have a system for removing people except through impeachment and conviction. We haven't tried doing that. They did manage to pressure Nixon out of office to resign, but could have also gotten him out the other way. And there was no, you know, formal coup d'etat that occurred there. The idea is that you have to kind of suck it up at a certain point. You know, President Bush, by the end of his term, was in the low 20s on approval ratings, had driven the economy into the ground, had royally messed up on foreign policy, and we didn't just overthrow him because that was the most convenient thing. We just organized for the next election and won that election and got into power. And that is kind of the way that it should work. They only let Morsi be president for about a year exactly, maybe 13 months or so. That is going to set, as I said, a very bad precedent in Egypt and in the broader region, if not the rest of the world, that this idea that it's okay to do these so-called safeguarding for democracy military coups. If you look at the statistics on governments, democracies established by military coups as sort of this transitional guardianship role, they have an astronomically high failure rate. That's one reason that this government fell this past week, and it's probably a bad sign for the government that will replace it whenever there's actually an elected government there, if that in fact ever actually happens. Was the Morsi government ideal? Was it committing some abuses? Was it trying to centralize power? Yeah, I think that happens in a lot of these situations, especially in a newer democracy. And he was probably even more dependent on his political party to maintain a base of control because he lacked a parliament that he could count on to help with some of the governing of the country. I don't think that putting in the Deputy Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who's been in office, who had been in that position for maybe 4 days or something before he got put in as president, that's just bizarre to me. I don't think that that's going to help fix any actual situation, and it's just going to make it that much harder to instill democratic values on the situation. So, Persephone, I wanted to get your thoughts on kind of this situation. Is this a democratic transition? Is it a democratic overthrow? Is it better to have overthrown it or not? What should the United States' reaction be here?
Okay, well, not to give a non-answer, but I think that what's going on here is that you know, Morsi was not entirely behind democratic ideals himself, and neither was, obviously, the military, which decided to do this thing, which, can I call it a coup? Am I allowed
yeah,
to?
Yeah, we can definitely call it a coup.
Yeah, so, you know, obviously not very democratic. But I think that what's going on here is that democracy in some ways is this promise, a sort of pact between two forces. So you have the party that gains power, and they are they have this understanding where if they mess up, they're not going to get reelected. And so in theory, they're supposed to try to stay in line with what the people want. And then at the same time, there's this sort of understanding that force will not be used against them. The government will not be overthrown. And so I think that what's going on here, because this is an early democracy, we're seeing that much more coming into play much more than it would in an established democracy, you know, like in Europe or Canada or somewhere like that.
Well, and the other thing worth remembering here is that it really does take a long time to build democratic institutions and respect for those democratic institutions. As late as the late 1950s, there was an attempted military coup in France. You would think that France would have kind of figured out democratic values at that point. Not, in fact, the case. I mean, you could argue that the military coup was pretty much successful because the government resigned in favor of Charles de Gaulle, who was a member of the military, and he just happened to shortcut the coup that was in progress. The goal was to put him in power, and he just told them, oh, by the way, there's about to be a military coup, so I guess you should probably resign. But he just didn't literally threaten them with guns or anything like that. I mean, that was just, you know, a little over a half century ago, and that was in France. As you're saying, in Europe, we've now gotten to a point where we generally have more respect for democratic institutions. It does take a long time to build these value systems, and when they shortcut it like this a year into it, that becomes a serious problem. Now, to touch on a kind of side tangent point that you brought up, you were mentioning about this the word coup here. Fun fact, if the United States calls something a coup formally, they are legally bound to cut off military aid to that government, and they provide $1.3 billion, I believe it was, or something on that order, of military aid each year to Egypt, mainly for shoring up the border with Israel in the Sinai and Gaza and that sort of whole area, and generally just kind of, as I said, employing all those potentially unemployed young men who could be turned to radicalism and other things. And so the United States has been very reluctant to refer to this as a coup because they do not want to cut off the military aid because that would have a major destabilizing effect on Egypt. Their worry is, I think it's a lot like kind of the, you know, if the United States refers to something as genocide instead of acts of genocide, then they are required to act under the UN convention that governs that sort of thing. Now, another issue here is what's going to happen next in Egypt. Is this going to be just people are going to accept it after maybe some initial clashes, or are we looking at an Algeria situation? Algeria was, of course, the thing that kind of kicked this all off. Before the end of the Cold War, no one really cared about if there was a military coup or something like that. It was just like, well, did it bring to power a pro-Soviet government or a pro-US government? We don't really care if it's democratic or not. After the Cold War, the idea was, oh, it's going to be totally fine. We'll just, you know, only support democracy. That was kind of the ideal U.S. goal. And now we're free to, you know, support the ideal instead of the hard-nosed real politic type thing. And of course, the opposition to the Gulf War, actually, which was right at the kind of tail end of the Cold War, started galvanizing this more radicalized Islamist political movement in Algeria, which was holding its first democratic elections since the Algerian War for Independence had put the ruling party in power after being a rebel group against the French colonial rule. And so they're saying, okay, we're going to hold free elections. And they held those at the very end of 1991, at the end of December. There were supposed to be a two-round election for parliament. The first round ends up being won by this new Islamist political party. The elite there and the military just freaks out completely in Algeria, suspends the rest of the election. The ruling party is thrown out of power and the military takes direct control. This immediately launches a approximately 10-year civil war in Algeria. Some of the effects still being felt there. They have periodic terrorist attacks, and they have gradually kind of transitioned into a somewhat more democratic government. But it was a very long, painful process. And that was kind of the wake-up call in 1992 that said, hey, look, there is a risk of these Islamist political parties coming to power in these democratic elections. My opinion, though, is that you have to let them come to power. If they do a terrible job and are just awful, there will be consequences, and either they will get kicked out at the next election or they will not have elections, at which point they're no longer democratic and then can be removed by various other means. And that's kind of the thing here. As long as it's still somewhat democratic, and it was certainly flawed in Egypt, you got to wait for the next election to roll around. If the Muslim Brotherhood had somehow, you know, eliminated elections or rigged them in some way, then they would be just like the Mubarak regime of having these nominal elections where 95% of the vote or 99% of the vote goes to, goes to the ruling party. And at that point, it's not a democratic government. And then we can talk about whether or not they're removed by the military or a popular uprising or something. But I am concerned that this is going to turn into some sort of Algeria situation. I would hope not, but I've kind of given up on predicting what happens in Egypt at this point because of my ill-fated comments a week before the fall of the Mubarak government, where I said that he was never going to get kicked out of power. So I just kind of, you know, don't worry about it at this point. But, you know, and I think they're already seeing signs of this breakdown happening between the Islamist, the Salafist Al-Nur party and the liberals. They don't really like each other. It was sort of a weird partnership to go into with the military. The Salafists don't really get along with the military either, so that was extra strange. I think that this is going to break down into a lot more problems. I think they've probably created more problems than they've solved. Closing thoughts on this?
I think they need to get rid of semi-presidentialism for a parliamentary system, a full parliamentary system, and then we'll see these alliances between groups, which is what's happening, put to a democratic use.
Right, and people, they're either going to, you know, win an election outright and then have a majority governing coalition with a functioning opposition, or no one's going to win a majority and then the parties are going to have to work together, and that's going to help probably strengthen the democratic system as well. But yeah, I would definitely agree. We've seen time and again that having these presidential systems, or presidentialism, as you say, which is where it's basically very centralized control through a single president. In this case, the fact that he didn't need a parliament to run the country for a year, just as president, and could just be making laws, that's a serious problem. That's, of course, more of a French model, kind of, which is more of an extreme model of the U.S. model, where the president is pretty powerful as well. The idea here is put it back into a system where there's more decentralized control politically at the top, and there are more people who have to work together to get things done. That, of course, makes it harder to make, you know, these strong, bold decisions that are going to show leadership and move the economy or the whatever in the right direction. But that's not going to happen anyway in Egypt because of just the financial and economic disaster and money pit that they are. So I think it's probably, as you say, it's better to have a more parliamentary system. And of course, as we said at the beginning of the segment, there is a lot more to democracy than just elections. And I disagree with kind of the Republicans and the presidents, President Obama in the United States, kind of both harping on this point. It wasn't quite a coup because there's more to democracy than elections. And yeah, you do have to have respect for minority rights in addition to majority rule. But I do think that it is a fundamental undermining of the democratic system if you kind of just militarily annul the results of a democratic election, because you do need other things besides democratic free elections to have a democracy. But if you don't have them, you definitely don't have a democracy. So I think we'll close on that and get back into some of this more in the coming week. Persephone, thank you so much for joining me again this week here on Arsenal for Democracy.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy for July 7th, 2013. The show is recorded at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts every Sunday and is available for download from BillHumphreyResearch.com/radio on Monday nights. You can also hear a repeat of it on 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark, Delaware, or at WVUD.org every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin, my co-host, Persephone, and from my studio here in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.